Good morning. You're very welcome to the show. Let's have a look at the papers first. And basically a lot of priests and tweets today. So I suppose the old church and the new church. The Sunday Times has Irish clash with Musk on Twitter safety is inevitable. So EU enforcement role puts state on a collision course with Twitter, it seems. The Business Post has billions of euro in corporate tax this year, a once-off, finance warns. Now, they're predicting that business tax receipts in 2023 will be down by 2 billion. I'd say if they're only down by 2 billion, considering the levels they're at this year, we wouldn't be doing too badly. Their off-lead is tarnished. There was not notified of job losses at Twitter or Stripe, who have been held up as being the kind of saints in this compared to Twitter. And also, you wonder, is this this rumble of distant thunder at the picnic here on the bottom of the page? Housing starts fall by 14% as construction inflation hits sector. The Sunday Independent is leading with an Ireland Thinks opinion poll they have. Sinn Féin won't solve the housing crisis, say voters. So clearly voters think nobody can solve the housing crisis. And they also have TDs set to grill Twitter and Stripe bosses over job call. The Irish Mail on Sunday has a story 1 month on from the Chrysler disaster. Pope's gift to tragedy families. So the Pope sent rosary beads to the families. The Sunday World has a story about that murdered teenager, Keane Mulready Woods, and his father. And the Sun on Sunday has a story about a priest, again, calling out a Kinahan cartel fugitive to come home and face the music for a murder he did. And the Daily Star Sunday, just to give you a flavour of, they have their own take on climate change and they're kind of tying it in when I'm a celebrity, get me out of here. Beware of the cockroach. Bug farts are destroying the planet, apparently. I think the bug farts could be the least of our problems. Now, our panel this morning, Gerard Howland is a former senior political advisor for Fianna Fáil and he's an Irish Times contributor as well. Dr. Laura Bambrick is head of social policy and employment affairs at ICTU. Norman Crowley is chairman of the Cool Planet Group and a sometimes dabbler in making of electric cars. He was the closest thing we could get to Elon Musk at short notice. All the good parts of Elon Musk, I add. And Alison O'Connor is a columnist for the Irish Examiner. Good morning, everybody. Norman, just before we get on to all the bad news, little bit of an uplift for the country there. Mac Hansen on the front of a few of the papers today. You were at the match yesterday in the Aviva. It looked like the atmosphere was incredible.
It was fab, absolutely fab. And I love the Sunday Times headline this morning over his picture, Super Mac. Mm-hmm. You know, so great to be there. Amazing result. Ireland are really starting to look like something special, you know. So yeah, good news story for a Sunday. I'm sure there's a lot of people waking up with sore heads this morning. So
yeah, absolutely. It was a very physical match, though. I'd say all those mothers who worry about their kids playing rugby watching that were going, oh my God.
Yeah, I was next to a dad whose son plays and he was shocked and he said, I hope my wife's not watching this game.
So. Yeah. Okay, so on to the real news. So why don't we start with Twitter then? And Laura Bambrick, this is your area. So look, there's various stories there. I suppose the Business Post page, one tarnisher was not notified of job losses at Twitter or Stripe. So your thoughts on it?
Well, that would lead us to two conclusions. The first one would be that there are going to be fewer than 30 people laid off, or that the companies are in breach of Irish employment law. So why 30 people? While all employees, all workers have protections against redundancies, you get an additional layer if you're part of a collective redundancy, a mass layoff. And what is required there is two things. First of all, the employer must write to the worker and let them know that their job is at risk. And
then, which Twitter have done.
Well, we don't know.
We do know. Well, that's what they've done. They've told people your job is at risk or potentially impacted. and a process is kicking in. That's what has happened here.
So there was quite a bit of confusion and still is confusion around the 30 days. So that 30 days is a consultation.
Yeah.
And it allows the workers and their representatives, a union or an elected official amongst the employees, to go in and see what cost-cutting measures can be done, to look at the books. And then if there is job losses, and if those job losses are more than 30, then it kicks in that the Minister English or the Taoiseach, the lead manager, in the line manager in the Department of Employment should be notified.
Okay.
So if they are in breach, what is the consequences for them?
So are they in breach?
Well, we don't know. So I think we have to establish if there's more than 30. So if there's fewer than 30.
But are they, given that nobody has yet lost their job and they've been told your job is at risk, a consultation process is now kicking in for 30 days, you will be staying on the payroll. Apparently an election procedure is coming in now for them to elect representatives. So just so we're very kind of, let's be fair to everyone here. Are Twitter in breach if they've done all that, which is what they've done?
Well, some of the emails, the first email that went out looked like very much that people were on gardening leave. So for listeners listening in, that means that your notification period is kicking in. So in all of our contracts of employment, we will have, if you're going to lose your job, you're going to get notice. So if you're paid on a weekly basis, fortnightly or monthly, it's usually around that time. You'll get a week's notice, fortnight, monthly. In high-end, high-value jobs like this, it tends to be 3 months. So the first email that went out, it looked like people were going to get paid their notification period, but they wouldn't be required to work. So they would be an employee in all a name. They'd still get their monthly pay, but they'd be on gardening leave. So they'd be working out their notice. That's all well and good if there's fewer than 30 of them.
Okay.
Since then, we've had these mixed messages of people coming back and saying, no, it's actually, your job isn't gone. It's at risk of being gone and we're entering this consultation. So that's that 30 days where they can open the books and look at where cost measures can be done. And it's sadly, a reality of the world of work that jobs will be lost. And when that happens and when they're part of this collective, that's when the minister has to be notified. So if these companies, if these billionaire tech bros are in breach of Irish legislation, what is the penalty they pay? It's a mere €250,000 up to. Not as much as that.
So we're talking about a guy here who was fined 20 million by the SEC for a tweet and laughed it off.
Absolutely. Yeah. He's looking at charging us all $8 to verify ourselves. He only needs to get 30,000 to sign up that and pay the maximum penalty. Now, this is legislation that dates back to 1977. Admittedly, there's been tweaks along the way. So if we are facing into a winter of seeing massive of job loss, maybe it just might be sectoral, just in, but these are solvent businesses. That's the difference.
So your main point would be, Twitter is losing 4 million a day.
There's a difference between losing and solvent. And this is solvent. And only last week, he paid $44 billion. That was the price. That's the value of that company at this moment in time.
Well, it's the price. It's probably not the value, I think everyone agrees. And also a huge amount of that is debt, which the banks involved in the debt are now unable to sell on to anyone. So it's solvent maybe technically, but it is precarious.
I guess the point is that at the time of this legislation, $250,000 might have sounded like enough of a deterrent. And maybe for small, medium-sized business, that is. But the rules, looking at the type of employers we now have, our economy,
that legislation has to be,
as a matter of urgency, addressed if we are to safeguard workers' rights around redundancies.
Norman, billionaire tech bros riding roughshod over employment rights?
I mean, it is funny about Twitter when you think about it. It's not to say
it's not funny for the people who are hundreds of people worried about losing their jobs. Let's be clear.
If you look at Dublin at the moment in terms of tech, it's still an incredibly buoyant market, right? And so it's very different to a meat factory going bust in some region in the country where it's very hard to get jobs. everybody leaving Twitter will get snapped up, right? And plus, we don't know yet in Twitter in Dublin how many people are going to get laid off. The reason for that is I'm sure Twitter are looking at Dublin and going, this is our regional centre. We can only fire X number of people before we get a tax problem. So there's probably decisions like that being made. Stripe as well. Like they, I'd say they have their minds made up exactly how many they're laying off, because I know that some of them flew off over the weekend to San Francisco. So they've got their, they know what the number is for here. Yeah.
And yeah. And look,
the other thing, just Stripe, on contravention
Stripe
of...
Stripe were promising 1,000 new jobs in Ireland a month or two ago, wasn't it?
So quarter one was looking very buoyant for them. Yeah. Absolutely. It's looking thing. But I think painting a picture in Dublin of desolation among the tech people, like there's still a huge amount of open jobs in tech in Dublin. So it's very different to other types of layoffs, you know. And then if you look at Twitter globally, he's going to lay off 3,500 people. The 7,000 people, he's going to lay off at least 3,500, because he's running towards getting to profitability there. And they've had it very good for 10 years in Twitter, and they haven't innovated that product. It's the same product as 10 years ago. They haven't done a tap in that company, right? And what he's doing moving in is he's fixing that problem. And that's just the reality of it.
Yeah, fair enough.
Alison, you're making faces there. I'll bring you back in a minute, Laura.
I just think that maybe that what Norman isn't addressing or ignoring is that you mentioned Stripe there. You contrast the communication that Stripe has had with its employees compared to how Musk has dealt with it. And I think it's particularly public, particularly cruel. And despite all that we know about the state that Twitter is in, so much of what Elon Musk does always just seems about looking after number one. I mean, the man is a complete dick. You know, it's not, it's, you know, I've...
In your opinion,
you know what? I've always thought that. I feel particularly justified in that he's an absolute egotist. Look, okay, I appreciate that he obviously has some skill in business. But I mean, I would also add that my name is Alison and I'm a Twitter addict. And I have spent the last few days really grappling with my conscience in terms of opening up Twitter and doing the usual looking at it. Also being conscious that in my job, it's a very important part of the toolkit.
And should you
get
that tool
now
for free?
I wouldn't mind having to pay for it. I don't know what this says about me that I never had a blue tick. I don't even know how you'd go about getting one. So that wouldn't particularly put me up or down, but that it's also important in terms of so much interaction goes on in terms of politics. You know, even in the papers today, you'll read stories that say so-and-so said on Twitter, you know, that so on that platform it is. There's this new thing now called Mastodon. I'd never heard of it. It sounds like something you'd put in a cow's udders to treat something. So I think that I know for people who have never gone near Twitter, I'm sure they're thinking, what is this all about? But it actually has, for all sorts of reasons, become important.
So then who should own it and who should control it?
Yeah, well, I mean, that horse has bolted, in that Musk has taken it over now, but I think for all of the wrong reasons. When we saw him retweeting,
you know, people own
when we
saw him re- for all the wrong reasons,
no, but when we saw him
too,
retweet that tweet about Nancy Pelosi's husband, which cast doubt on, you know, on how that 82-year-old man was attacked and his head fractured. I mean, for anyone who was in any doubt, as where you see that how much of the workforce that are involved in moderating and protecting people who are on Twitter who have gone, that's such a blunt instrument. It does not in any way bode well for the future. And I suppose it just says a lot about everything else that's going on in the world. You even look at the midterm elections coming up in the next few days in the States and how it'll play out there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And we'll come back to that. Gerard?
My understanding is nobody has been fired in Twitter in
no,
Dublin.
They haven't. No.
And whether the important regulations that Laura has highlighted are going to be followed or not, I think, is yet to be seen. And I think...
Well, there is a 30-day consultative process is kicking in. And I think we do know that the staff have been told they can elect, there will be an election of representatives to deal with that, which does sound as if they are following some kind of process.
The point being, it's too soon to rush to judgment on that. Whether the legislation is adequate for its purpose, I take your point, Laura. But that horse has bolted now as well. So that's for the future. But I'd really like to pick up on something Norman said about tech jobs in Dublin. I'm sure there are tech jobs in Dublin, But my understanding is there's rapidly going to be far fewer opportunities, and that reality has already arrived.
Yeah.
That a lot of these people are going into what is very quickly becoming a much tougher environment. And taking that most of them, I hope, are on good jobs and good salaries, they have rents and mortgages that are consummate to their good salaries. So the depth of their problem is correspondingly greater in this property market where they have to provide for themselves. And the fact is, the world is about to go into an unprecedented recession.
Unlike, is it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Unlike anything since 2008. I hope it's not going to be nearly as bad. Let's see what happens over the next couple of months. But we are going into a very difficult year in the tech sector and across the board. And in relation to your own point, when you opened the show, Brendan, about the 2 billion we may lose as a country on the back of corporation tax, that's bigger than our margin of error in terms of our national budget, in terms of keeping ourselves in surplus, which is our plan.
Is our surplus not looking like 6 or 7 billion this year, though?
If
we only lose 2 billion, like compared to how much they're inflated this year, you would think that 2 billion is a best case scenario of what it goes down next year.
But based on the increased corporation tax that has arrived in the second, third and fourth quarter, but if you go back to last year, what was projected, the surplus was less than 2 billion. The projected surplus that we would have had was less than 2 billion.
Without getting bogged down, the point is the actual surplus. Mm. We could take 2 billion off the actual surplus.
And it's not just a matter of corporation tax. It is the income tax.
I think it would be more than 2 billion.
And it's the money down. It's almost like it's our methadone. It's the money down the back of the sofa that's always, we've always managed to find, and always just before the budget. And the difficulty is in, I think the problem is that the finance minister is almost seen as the boy who cried wolf this, because they're all, for the last number of years, they've been warning and it hasn't happened. But as Gerard said, this time we really are in trouble. And even in relation to the tech industry, nobody seems, it's a bit like housing, nobody seems quite sure which way it's going to go, but that ultimately it's not good. It's, the question is, how bad is it going to be?
Okay, so Laura, I'll come back to you in a sec. I want to ask Norman with your insight into it. So we saw Jack Dorsey come out and say, it's my fault, I grew Twitter too fast and I'm sorry. Mm. And we saw the Stripe, the Collison brothers come out and say, we grew too fast, we're sorry. Mm. So how bad is what's coming in the tech industry, do you think? Are we going to, and we've seen Zuckerberg say similar, that a lot of you probably shouldn't be here, and he clearly wants rid of Deadwood as well. Mm. So are these companies all bloated in terms of employees and everything? Yeah.
They are. They've overhired over the years. Even the Collison brothers said that. There's another thing. They were making so much money that they were harbouring developers and talent so that other companies wouldn't get it. And that's a well-known fact that they've been doing that. And then people come into these places and they got no work to do. And that's been written about. And now what's happening is they're having to clear out those people. Just to come back to something there on the tax take for Ireland, remember that our surplus is created by tech and also created by the medical sector. And the medical sector is absolutely booming, right? The other thing about tech is it's not Stripe that's contributing it or Twitter. It's Apple. It's a very small set of ones. And they're going for a slightly tough time over the next year or two, but it's nothing compared to some of these others.
Do you think?
Yeah. And the minister and finance can see that coming through. They know where the money is coming from. They don't mention it in the articles, but they know where it's coming from.
But Norman, they've told us repeatedly.
They're warning.
No.
They're warning.
They have told us repeatedly, to allow me to finish, that they actually do not have a clear forecast of future corporation tax. They don't quite understand how it's happening, how the boom is so boomy. And they've been very frank about their lack of understanding, which in fact is commendable and understandable.
They haven't said Armageddon is coming. They said we should be careful about this. And they should
have,
be careful.
And they haven't been as careful as they said we should be. And furthermore...
Well, in fairness, now, Gerard, they've been using it for one-off.
Yes, one-off, year in, year out.
They haven't been baking it in every year.
Sorry, one-off, year in, year out, into a fourth year is not one-off.
But they've been putting away some for a rainy day.
It's only a couple of weeks ago since we had an 11 billion budget. And one-off or not, that is a hell of a lot of money.
And the morning after, the last budget in this station on Morning Ireland, the tarnished etcetera more is needed. We'll be looking at that soon too.
Yeah. Okay.
But more is always needed.
You wanted to come back in there, Laura.
Yeah, I think I'd take in your point that, you know, there will be a lot of people that are listening that are based, you know, in Twitter, Dublin headquarters and in Stripe, that losing your job at any time is a bruising experience. Mm-hmm. Having it happen so public, so indiscriminate, in such a brutal manner will be taking its toll. And that's why legislation is there to protect against that and to protect employers doing that. It doesn't matter if they're going out into a healthy recruitment environment, if they have very
high transfer. How can you say it doesn't matter? Isn't that, if they've been laid off, isn't that the main thing, is that they're going out into a lucrative market?
So an employer that breaches employment law
Hang on a minute now. Let's be very careful here. We do not, there is no evidence they have breached employment law. They have warned people about a redundancy. They have said there will be a process. So let's just be careful, I think, what we're saying here.
And by the way, I can guarantee you Twitter and Stripe in Dublin have the biggest employment lawyers working for them right now. And they don't want to breach anything, and they have the biggest law firms making sure they don't breach any employment.
Yeah, no, of course, the laws of humanity, Laura, are something else. Then, as you point out, the manner of this being done to people.
I do think you have to point out that, like, how long is it since Musk took over? How quick in a week? I mean, and that this was a worldwide thing. Like, how well prepared could they have been? No matter how many legal suits you have. So, I mean, I think there's an element now we're seeing of
Were prepared. Should lawyers have known this is coming for months? Twitter's lawyers.
Well, not necessarily, Norma, because Musk actually tried to wriggle out of the purchase.
I know, Musk did signal very clearly he was going to do this. Yeah,
I know, but you're looking at how many. So are you saying that therefore the lawyers went off on their own and said, let's plan this before Musk had even come in?
Musk,
do you know what I mean?
Musk, there's an element of, lawyers and said, what do we need to do to stay on the right side of the law?
But when do you think he did that? Even before he was in charge of Twitter, how would he have been able to do that
because
he was
knew
in charge
eight
of Twitter?
Weeks ago he was going to close.
Yeah, but
the deal.
He was not in charge of how
he
could he contact Twitter's lawyers at
he
that
doesn't
point?
Need to
contract.
It's
his own lawyers.
In fairness, I think he has brought in his own team and he has brought in his own legal advisor, and he is apparently locked in an office, from what I read.
Yeah.
With six people, investors and people he trusts from down the years. Apparently, a lot of senior staff have no access to him and no communication.
Yes, but he also
he's
has told.
What about these Twitter
staff that he said, you have to work, this is last weekend, I believe, you work through the weekend now, and if you don't come up with these new features, you're gone. I mean, that's hardly the work of a man who has been preparing diligently and laying the ground and telling people what he wants. It's a worldwide organisation, and I imagine if you're trying to even the best laid plans, it would be difficult to implement.
And the point comes back down to at the cost of breaching Irish employment law is so minimal that if you were anyway an employment law, you'd say, suck it up.
Yeah.
That would be my advice.
A quarter of a million is still a lot of money. Not minimal.
Look, it's all relative. As I said, sell 30,000 blue ticks and you have your a quarter of a million paid.
Okay. Now, I was going to move on to politics. We have to go to Sharm el-Sheikh in 3 minutes. Am I right? In 3 minutes. So just let's, for a couple of minutes, can we meditate on the broader issues around Twitter here, Gerard? You picked that piece on the front of the Sunday Times. Irish clash with Musk on Twitter safety, inevitable. And I suppose this is more into the whole area of truth and everything else.
Yeah, and one of the points in that piece, which struck me as so true and me as so stupid for not having realised this more clearly earlier, is that this is not an economic investment by Elon Musk. This is about an investment in power and influence primarily. And if this man is so rich that the level of this investment is if not peripheral, not central to his economic plan, and if this for the same reason, of course, that very wealthy people bought newspapers and television stations down the years, if this is what this is about, there's a full-on challenge not only to Irish regulatory capacity, which is central from a European perspective because companies are based like this are based here, but also to democracy because Twitter is incredibly important. If you look at Iran at the moment, Twitter is important in Iran for good reasons.
Yeah.
If you look at the two referenda we had here over the last few years, Twitter was important for good reasons. Twitter can be important for bad reasons as well, but it has to be self-regulated. It has to be externally regulated. Mm. It's such a powerful vehicle that there just has to be a huge focus internally and externally to make it on balance and influence for good, not bad. And I would be deeply concerned that that balance has been tilted in the wrong directions with okay. all sorts of consequences.
Do you know Musk, Norman?
I've met him once. Yeah. And just on that point, Twitter today is a sewer of negativity and bots, right? Everyone at the moment...
Twitter
is
probably a reflection of people. There's good and bad there.
There's a whole lot of bots. There's a whole lot of state actors doing that kind of thing. Everyone at the moment makes it sound like Musk's going to come in and make this thing way worse. This thing is a mess, right? And full of all sorts of bots controlling messaging all over the place. They've been sanctioned by the US government repeatedly in the past. Like, you look at somebody coming in who can make a car drive itself. Maybe this is the guy who could fix this thing.
Yeah, no, his record of making the cars drive themselves is a little bit shaky, but let's be kind and say maybe he's getting there. OK, put on your headphones. There's much bigger problems in the world than Twitter. And Dr. Tara Shine, CEO of Change by Degrees, a sustainability consultancy, is on the line. Good morning, Tara.
Hi, how are you?
Hi. So, Tara, you're over there in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt for COP27. Are you gone? Is Tara there? Okay. Yeah, we just bear with us a second because we'd like to get her back on the line now. No. Okay, look, we'll try and get back to Dr. Tara Shine there. Will we move on briefly to our own problems again, Alison? So the Sunday Independent poll, you've picked the front page story that's been taken out of this. And look, it's an opinion poll. It's a snapshot. But 68% of people think Sinn Féin won't solve the housing crisis.
Yeah, this is an Ireland Thinks poll. And I suppose, and by the story by Hugh O'Connell, and I suppose you also put it in the context of the recent Irish Times poll. And this one also provides slightly better news for the government.
So the breakdown
and the
of
government
parties
will be glad to see that Sinn Féin is at 34-3, Fine Gael 21%, no change, Fianna Fáil 17%, no change, and then the Greens are 3%, and that's -1. And just to say that the poll was taken by just over 1,000 people, a margin of error of between ±3%. So it is, that's the most interesting thing to see that that the amount of people who do not believe that that Sinn Féin would be able to solve the housing crisis, and that's therefore I'm trying to find that figure just now. About 58% of voters answered no when asked if they believed a Sinn Féin led government would resolve.
As it's 58%. Sorry, I might have said 68 58.
So okay. With just 24% saying that that party could, and 17% were unsure. I think maybe that is indicative, though, of, I mean, that surprised me a little bit. But I guess, is it indicative of how entrenched people, how hopeless people feel about it? And that is also something that has struck me about Sinn Féin possibly coming into government, as it looks at the moment like they will, that it's an incredibly tough ask, or the expectation is incredibly high, that you would think that so many people were almost going to imagine that Sinn Féin would have the housing crisis solved by next week. And that what a tall order to solve the housing crisis and to unite Ireland. You know what I mean?
Sinn Féin have said it'll take two electoral cycles.
It's the expectation that people have. This is part of how good Sinn Féin are as an opposition party. They have built that expectation.
They don't have, that people don't have that expectation, which is interesting.
That is, and I mean, it does... I have to say that does surprise me, and I think that I think people, once, if Sinn Féin get into government, I still think there will be an enormous amount of pressure where people will expect that they will, the expectation will expect change. The one other aspect of it that I was really...
Can I just bring in Laura for a second because she's keen to get in there.
Yeah, I agree with you. That was an interesting aspect of the poll. But I think what was more interesting was we're going through a cost of living crisis. This should be manna from heaven from parties of the opposition. And government parties should be bleeding support. Instead, what we're seeing is the three government parties taken together, more or less maintaining their support, one percentage point down, but the main party of opposition losing three and other oppositions not gaining.
But still miles ahead, we should say.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Head and shoulders. But yeah. Given the situation that we're in, an 11 billion budget, that's what we're having. And Kevin Cunningham, the managing director of Ireland Thinks, he writes and says, although the last month's tracker poll for them came after the budget, it's only now those once-off cost of living
because the payments,
are coming in. This week we all got our €200 against our cost, our energy costs, double child benefit payments. The week before there was some social welfare bullet payments, as they were known, cash payments. So even when we're looking at how fearful people are about paying their bills, last month it was half of all people polled. This month, still significant, but it's down to one third. So people,
so government is working, is it?
Government. So the panel was also asked, would you prefer a party of change, a Sinn Féin led government, or would you re-vote back in the government? And there's a hair's breadth in between it. 43% said a Sinn Féin led government, and 41% well, as a minor party, but to return the existing government, 41%, a midterm point. That's an absolutely incredible. If I was in government buildings today, I would be saying 11 billion well spent.
Okay. All right. I think we can go back now to Dr. Tara Shine. Are you there, Tara?
I am, Brendan.
Hi. Hi. Okay. Good to hear your voice. Now, you're in Sharm el Sheikh at COP27. So look, in general, how is this year shaping up so far as people are getting ready for it?
Yeah, I think, you know, well, obviously there's a lot going on in the world, and all of that has an influence on the geopolitics of a COP as well. But the real imperative at this COP is to get beyond making commitments and pledges, because we have plenty of those, and we've set everything out according to the Paris Agreement and its rule book. So now it's all about action and implementation. So how we actually start to bring emissions down, how we really get engaged with helping developing countries to make their transition, and how we start to deal with the damages that are already starting to happen because of the extreme weather events all around the world.
So it does look as if this phrase loss and damage that we suddenly all know now, as if that is going to be a kind of a key battleground this year.
Yeah, and loss and damage has been an issue in the negotiations for years and years. And basically, it's around the unavoidable impacts of climate change. So if you're a country like Pakistan, you can prepare for floods, you can have early warning systems, but that you can get, then you can get something like a flood that is so great and so unprecedented that there's nothing human beings could have done to avoid it or to be better prepared for it. And the losses, like the GDP losses, the losses of life, the losses of culture, the losses of livelihood, who's responsible for picking up the cost of that? That's the question that loss and damage deals with. And because we haven't reduced emissions, even though we said we would for years and years and years, and because we haven't reduced emissions, the climate has warmed more, so we're having more of these impacts. And now, for many countries, the only way out is to bring up this issue of loss and damage, because we have failed miserably to do the emissions reductions we said we would do 10 years, 15 years ago.
And this is essentially the wealthier countries now need to compensate the global south, or whatever the phrase we're using these days, for the historical damage that has been done to the climate, which the global south is suffering more from.
Yeah, and which the global south is not responsible for.
Yeah.
So historically, most of the emissions come from us, from the wealthier countries. And so this falls under something like reparations, where a harm is done by someone or some set of countries to another set of countries. So, yeah, it's not Pakistan's fault that the climate is changing. It's much more the fault of the industrialized countries, those that have used lots of fossil fuels and caused lots of pollution to date.
And are the industrialised countries, are they inclined to want to pay sufficient loss and damage?
No. Right. But there again, if they had made the emissions reductions that they had promised, you know, under Kyoto and that we've been talking about for years and years, then we wouldn't have got to this point. But this is a result of that failure to prevent dangerous climate change. Now the dangerous climate change is starting to happen all around us, and this is a consequence of inaction.
And you're presenting a UN report today, and this is essentially a snapshot of where we are at now, and it's depressing stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's depressing and it's not depressing. So this is some summary or synthesis report of 2 years of a dialogue between scientists and policymakers. And what we find is that, you know, the 1.5 goal, that temperature goal that we're all aiming for since Paris, that's still just about within reach. But I mean only just about. We really have to, you know, peak emissions between now and 2025 and then bring them down. Like, we really have to try and halve them by 2030. That's what we're trying to do. Yet at the moment, the current trajectory is we have increased emissions by 10% by 2030. It's all of this is in our own interest. It's about keeping ourselves safe and our children safe and, you know, having the prospect of prosperity and a good quality of life. So we have everything to gain by doing whatever we can to act on this slim window we have. In this coming decade to actually, you know, stop emitting, stop using fossil fuels and bring those emissions down. They'll keep us safe in the end of the day.
So 1.5 is still alive, but just about. Is that what you're saying, Tara?
Yeah. I mean, they said it was, I think Alex Sharma, it was said at COP26 in Glasgow that 1.5 was on life support. I don't know what the next step on from life support is, last gasp or something. Yeah, we're in the last gasp.
Okay.
And again, you know, I just don't see why we wouldn't do this, because there are, you know, it's going to avoid costs, because otherwise we're going to have to pay for all these losses and damages down the line. And it allows us to have a livable future and our kids to have a livable future. So there's everything for us and our interests to actually start making these changes now and stop putting them off.
OK, Dr. Tara Shine, CEO of Change by Degrees, thank you very much. So, Norman, I suppose you're the person who's this most with a skin in the game here. It's interesting what Tara says there about that. It makes no sense for us not to face up to this and do it, but we're not doing it.
No, we are. So a couple of interesting things very quickly. The International Energy Agency, who are basically funded by the oil and gas companies, came out with a whole bunch of numbers a couple of weeks ago, and their preference always is to upplay oil and gas and downplay the green side. And they've always got their numbers wrong about how fast we're moving. And their latest numbers show that we're moving very quickly on climate. Like, to give you a number, in order to start climate change, you need to spend $5 trillion a year. It's a bag load of money, right? They've always said that's laughable, that'll never happen. Their latest set of numbers said by 2030, we'll be spending $2 trillion. If you take into account how wrong they've been all the time, that would say that by then we'll be probably spending that target of $5 trillion a year. That means a lot of these problems will get sorted. I think COP, I'm down on COP, like the FT called it low-key and procedural is what's happening in Egypt at the moment. Which
but do
is
we not need,
code
need
for,
procedure and
well,
low-key?
Well, we do,
like,
but
we
it's
need
just...
people to grind out the details
well,
of
we absolutely
how we're
do,
do this.
But are they doing it, or are they having martinis over in Egypt at the moment? Right? Nothing meaningful seems to happen at these things one after the other. The meaningful things that are happening are actually happening with announcements like... One that very few people mention is like Lula da Silva coming back in Brazil, right? Like he's huge for climate change because he's going to stop, destroying the rainforests. It's always been his thing. Things like that are a lot more meaningful. And a point there as well about the developed countries paying. Yes, they should pay. But a big challenge you have is what happens when you give Pakistan a boatload of money? These countries have to develop faster too to be able to use this money properly. Otherwise, that money will get paid and it'll just disappear, you know. And there are real issues around that as well that are never talked about at COP. It's like, let's give them more money. Of course we should give them more money, but what happens when we give it to them? you know. Okay. And in, just to finish that point, in Ireland, like, we've had climate damage here. You can go to a whole load of county towns and they've all put up new flood defences, and that money came from the state. So, like, these developing countries have to do the same, but you need a proper grown-up infrastructure there so that that money doesn't get wasted. And that has to happen as well.
I think there's a good piece in the Business Post this week, Daniel Murray, picking up on a lot of those points that Tara made about saying that Africa is the least responsible for global warming but bears the worst impact. But going back to the poll that we were discussing earlier, and it says, this Sunday Independent poll, which of the following issues should be the two most important priorities to deal with? And climate change is at 14%, and that is just +2. I mean, that's incredibly low when you're given the crisis that is facing us. We were talking before we came in about how mild it is. We're in November. I was saying I haven't got out my proper winter coat yet. Mm. And I mean, that's extraordinary. It's been good for the energy crisis. But it also strikes me that over the last month or so, and I'd say this is the same in households across Ireland and probably across Europe, realised how ridiculously wasteful we are. Right, I spend my time now going around, turning off lights, giving out to the kids, telling them to have shorter showers, using the tumble dryer far less. And that is, it's an interesting study in human nature. And that is because of the notion of financial penalty if we don't do that, right?
Yeah.
And look, it's also showing
there's a big argument that the price of gas going through the roof has been the best thing that could happen for the environment. So that
I think the much
demonized market in a way could be working some kind of magic.
But it also comes back to the point that I think so many people feel helpless in terms of, I think that if there was more guidance from the government about things that can be done that would make a difference, a sense of the collective national campaigns. It just doesn't happen. It's just too disparate. And people then are left feeling helpless. And then we get our national knickers in a twist over rows about turf and ridiculous sort of, you know, things like that. And rather than it ever being in any way sort of a constructive debate whereby we can do something or rouse about emissions from agriculture, you know, and it ends up nowhere.
There's lots of other things I want to get onto, so we leave that there. But for people who think we're not giving enough attention, I will be talking to Greta Thunberg after 12 about this. So we'll take a break now. Our panel, Gerard Howland, Dr. Laura Bambrick, Norman Crowley and Alison O'Connor, staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel still with us, Gerard Howland, Dr. Laura Bambrick, Norman Crowley and Alison O'Connor. And we will move on now to religion, I think, and priests. And I think, Gerard, we saw two faces of religion this week and it's in the papers today. And are we fine with it if it's touchy-feely and being supportive to people, but we don't like it when it's actually old-fashioned religion with rules and stuff like that? Is that roughly?
Well, the bouncy castle Catholics have had a hard week, it seems.
Okay.
I mean, there were two good pieces in the papers today. One by David Quinn in the Sunday Times, but also in the Sunday Independent Irish Hanlon about this. And what Father Sheehy said in the stall, and I mean, I might be the oldest, nearly the oldest, maybe the oldest person in the conversation, but it was exactly what I was taught in school. Word for word, pretty much. These are sins, and then there are mortal sins, and mortal sins are the gateway to hell, which is eternal. I was pretty clear about what I was being told, and he seemed to be, roughly speaking, saying the same. And he does have a right to speak.
As the tarnisher did, in fairness, say.
And yeah. I thought it was very interesting about Leo Varadkar's contribution. He completely disagreed with what Father Sheehy had to say, but he did emphasise his right to speak, which is different.
When does it become hate speech?
That is a very good question. And that dial is moving, I think, in our generation, in our time. It hasn't gone there yet. It might go there in the future, and then you have a complete cultural clash that we will find it difficult to mediate, because on the one hand, I don't think people can be sent to hell because they are gay, because they are living in a second union, or they're living in a union where they have not been married. I don't believe any of that. But if this is the tenet of a traditional religion that was an absolute central pillar of our entire culture for as long as history is recorded, how does that then end up suddenly, within a generation, with outside the bounds of what is acceptable? And this is, we live in strange times. Maybe we live in wonderful times.
Yeah, maybe there's but nothing strange
one thing about,
it. About
liberalism. Liberalism is ultimately about your upholding and trying to help other people's views that are contrary to yours. Yeah. And then it comes to that question, Brendan, which you correctly raised. What is hate speech?
Alison?
Yeah, I agree with all of that. But I also think that there's been a lot of pretendy going on both sides. For particularly in more recent years, and that yes, those the looking at David Quinn this morning, and where he is pointing out that I suppose the hypocrisy of in many ways of liberals, and I thought I really admired Leo Varadkar's statement and in what he said, and I was kind of intrigued by Dr. Brown, the Bishop of Kerry's statement, where he said that this shouldn't have been brought up at a regular parish mass, but the implication there was. There could be another forum where you might.
He said it was among friends.
Yes, where he said it was. He said it wasn't the Christian approach, but for me, implied in that is that it's the Catholic approach. So yeah. That would be okay, you know. So I mean, it's he didn't. And it, apologies to those who were offended, which struck me as a very kind of traditional Fianna Fáil apology. Do you know what I mean? But you just go back to the fact, Father Sheehy was involved in shaking the hand of that man who was convicted of sexual assault, I think around 10 years ago in Listowel. It was a shocking case. Even the comments that he made afterwards, he had to stand down as parish priest of Castle Gregory at that time. Now, someone I know...
Did he?
For someone sure, yeah. I know yeah. told me that they used to just go to Mass then to hear what he had to say. But how was that man allowed on the altar to say those things, if indeed, you know, as Dr. Brown said, it was a terrible thing that people were offended. But the second thing I would say is, I imagine, as my contact at Castle Gregory would say, that man is notorious, not just in Kerry, but everywhere. So why would you darken the door of a church where he's going to be standing on the altar?
Yeah.
And why would you be sort of surprised that you're going to get what is Catholic doctrine?
Yeah, Laura, we could ignore him, like.
Well, I think what was interesting, the Ireland Thinks Sindo poll again asked people about this.
We're not going to weigh the whole programme on one opinion poll now. Let's just be careful.
Well, it's a representative it's a representative poll, and fewer than 1 in 20 people admitted that they hadn't heard of the controversy, which means 19 in 20 had. This is a sermon that happened down in Kerry, and the reason why, as Alison and Gerard have mentioned, he was spouting Catholic doctrine. What gave him the platform to amplify what he said?
Twitter?
Was media. Not at all. He went from local Kerry news to being filleted on the 1 o'clock news by Brian Dobson, an absolute gentleman, to then going over, thinking nothing of throwing himself into the lion's den of Liveline, and then over to the commercial radios. We have acres of print media today talking about a sermon in a local church in Kerry.
I was kind of saying this to a more intelligent woman than me the other day, right? And I said, why are we giving this all the attention? And, you know, sure, like he's just... And she said, well, the thing is, it's important that we say that this is not okay.
Absolutely.
And it's important that he not be allowed to empower other, as she called them crazies, but the other people who would be of this mindset, that we show that this is not acceptable anymore. Is that an argument, I wonder?
We amplified what he was saying. He said it in front of, I don't know how many people were in St. Mary's, but we know between, I think it was 10 and 40, depending on who you're talking to, walked out. And that was the correct, I'd imagine most people were there.
But isn't that, that's very much, it's a very good point, and it really is a sign of the modern times, and that it was actually citizen journalists who first broadcast it by making videos and putting it on social media. And you could, of course, argue that the last thing that man needed was the oxygen of publicity. But there is an element of runaway train when something like that gets up on social media and it's that outrageous and so many people are so hurt by it, the inevitable is going to happen.
Norman.
But just one, you were talking about weaknesses in legislation earlier, and I'm not a lawyer, but it would be interesting to use this opportunity to see what is our hate speech in this country? I don't know.
There's new legislation.
Is there?
Coming in.
Yeah. Yes, like, yeah. It'd be great to see it because I don't know. I grew up like you on learning about mortal sins.
It's a great attraction for mortal sins.
Just like, but I'd love to have lived through that and get to the point where we get proper hate speech legislation, where this poor old man gets hauled over the coals a little bit and stopped from doing it, you know? If it is hate speech.
Is it hate speech to say you're going to go to hell if nobody outside of the, you know, fundamentalist Catholics believe?
David Quinn raises this.
But hang on, do people believe in hell anymore? Is it hate speech then to say, for these imaginary sins, you will go to an imaginary place?
But what will this new, you know, this is a very interesting question, and it's been raised by a couple of people this morning, that will, you know, in that instance, would somebody like Father Sheehy be liable for prosecution?
And in that case, would Presbyterians, who I believe can have similar views, Muslims who can have similar views, are they all open to hate speech then? It's a very interesting question.
And people in the Church of Ireland. But I studied a long time ago the Inquisition for my history degree. And I was surprised, of course, it was set up for a charitable purpose. And the reason it was such a charitable purpose was if you had a physical ailment, it would destroy your body and you would die in this life on this earth. But if you were subsumed by sin or heresy, the damage would not be to your mortal body, it would be to your immortal soul, which you would suffer in the flames forever. And therefore it was charity that heresy and sin be exterminated.
But this priest is trying to save these people from themselves. Now, I want to reflect, and I'm not connecting this in any way to hate speech, Alison O'Connor, but I want to reflect that there have been an enormous amount of texts who take issue with you calling Elon Musk a dick. Is it fair to use male genitalia in such a way, says somebody? Don't think it'd be acceptable if female genitalia was used to describe an undesirable person, separate the person from their gender. So unedifying and reductive for a journalist to use base terminology on national radio, dealing facts, not personal vindictiveness, and on and on and on. OK, and you nod and take your punishment there. We have about 1 minute left. Norman Crowley, you are exercised about the bounties being taken out of the celebrations.
Hear, hear.
Let me just say, I know the world is facing a lot of issues right now. We've come over Halloween. There's a lot of challenges in the world, a lot of challenges to people who are losing their jobs. And we can all look forward to Christmas. And I'm just deeply worried that Mars are taking the bounty out of celebrations.
I don't think they're taking them out of all the celebrations.
Well, I heard this morning, and it's like, I love Ireland more and more. Ireland winning the rugby yesterday, I think. I talked to a lot of Americans who'd love to move to Ireland because they think America is fecked. And I just heard before I came on that in Irish celebrations, they're not taking the bounty out.
So glad to hear it. I think the celebration size is the ideal size for a bounty, actually, because it's a bit rich for a bigger bar, but it's perfect in that shape. And on that bombshell, we will leave it today. Thanks very much to our panel, Gerard Howland, Dr. Laura Bambrick, Norman Crowley and Alison O'Connor. We'll take a quick break.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.